So if we're going to ask the question of whether animals are intelligent, we have to make up our minds what we mean by intelligent. Now, some people think that plants are intelligent. After all, deciduous trees in the East, they drop their leaves in the fall, and they put out new leaves in the spring. They don't put them out in the middle of the winter when they would just freeze, right? That's intelligent. However, I think there are good reasons to think that plants don't know anything. So if a thing doesn't know anything, it can't be intelligent, okay? So it might act intelligently, but you can't attribute intelligence to it itself. Like computers, they act intelligently, but they're not intelligent. So animals have knowledge. But we wouldn't attribute intelligence to animals on the basis of their instinctual knowledge. So for example, if you have a dog, when dogs are indoors, sometimes they'll like spin around several times before they lie down. And that serves absolutely no useful purpose, okay? If they were outdoors, that's an instinct which would actually allow them to kind of even out the surface they're about to lie down on, if they're like leaves or stones or something like that. But indoors, it's absolutely pointless, but they do it anyway. So we see in the case of instinctive behavior that instinct is blind. The animal really doesn't know why it's doing what it's doing, okay? So intelligence then requires not just the ability to know, but also the ability to learn. So for example, there's a big difference between the dog spinning around pointlessly and a dog that knows how to shake hands. And there's this border collie named Rico who apparently can fetch over 200 different items, okay? That's an intelligent dog. Now, a really important distinction for this talk is the difference between sense knowledge and intellectual knowledge. So we have different ways of learning things. So I learned how to tie my shoes by using my senses and developed a certain hand-eye coordination, whereas I learned how to balance chemical equations using my intellect. So how does intellectual knowledge differ from sense knowledge? Well, the intellect is capable of grasping universal truths, such as physical and chemical laws, and certain philosophical truths, and even really basic truths, like the whole is greater than the part, and equals added to equals give equals. But in order to understand these truths, we must first form the individual concepts involved, whole, part, greater. Now, a number of thinkers maintain that there's no difference between a concept or abstract thought and a sense perception. However, our senses only know particular things. I see and smell this rose, not rose in general. And imagination is also a type of sensibility. I imagine this rose. I don't imagine rose in general. Whereas the intellect forms the universal concept rose, which it understands to belong to every particular rose that ever was, is, or will be. Now, again, a lot of thinkers deny that there's a difference between the intellect and the imagination. However, if you reflect right now on the contents of your own mind, you can see that there's a difference between what's in your imagination and what's in your intellect. So everyone, think of a dog. Okay. So for the sake of the example, I thought of a chihuahua. Okay, but at the same time that I imagined that chihuahua, I also brought forth in my mind the concept dog. Because if you ask me if a Great Dane is a dog, I'm going to say yes. And yet the image that I brought up was that of a chihuahua. So there's not an identity between the concept dog and images of dogs. And we also see this reflected in language. You can't say that this dog that you see over here is that dog that you see over there. And the same thing with images. If you have an image of a dog in one part of your mind, and then you imagine another one next to it, you can't say this one is that one. But you can say of every single dog that it's a dog. So the concept dog abstracts from what makes particular dogs the particular dogs that they are. And that's the difference between sensing and abstract thought. Again, you sense particulars, but abstract thought transcends the particulars and applies to every single one of them. All right, so how do we know that animals do not form and consider abstract ideas? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at what are considered the smartest animals. And if I can show that the smartest animals aren't capable of abstract thought, then the less endowed animals are not going to be capable as well, right? Things like lobsters and worms and so forth. So the smartest animals that we know are the great apes, the cetaceans, those are dolphins, whales, and so forth, and certain birds. Now, some apes have been taught symbolic means of communication. So in some cases, they taught the apes a kind of stripped-down version of American Sign Language. In other cases, they got the apes to use what they call lexigrams. So the lexigrams were used in different ways. So you might have a piece of cardboard, and on that piece of cardboard, there would be little squares, and in each square, there would be a symbol. So there would be a symbol for banana, there would be a symbol for tickle, and so forth. And then what the ape would do would simply point to the thing that the ape wanted. And they actually also put these on computers so that there was a computer keyboard with the symbols on, and then the ape could depress the key, and then it would light up on the screen, and so they could make little sentences like, give banana, okay? Now, what one sees if one looks at transcripts of their utterances is that they never ask questions for the purpose of gaining ideas about the world. Yet, if they had the ability to form concepts about the world, they would naturally desire to actualize this ability. And once they had words in order to express questions about the world, they'd start asking questions about the world. We see this in human children. According to a survey of 1,000 mothers, I don't know how scientific it was. It was done by an online retail store. Okay. All right. But according to that survey, mothers are asked nearly 300 questions a day. Yeah, nearly 300 questions a day. Okay. So maybe that number is way too high, but little kids do ask a lot of questions. Okay. And according to the survey, the five toughest questions mothers get asked are, 35% of mothers get asked, why is water wet? 34% get asked, where does the sky end? 33% get asked, what are shadows made out of? 20% are asked, why is the sky blue? And 18% are asked, how do fish breathe underwater? Okay. So what this shows is that while certainly children ask questions to get things like cookies, they also ask many questions simply to increase their intellectual understanding of the world. Okay, and that's what's key here. They're asking questions simply to increase their intellectual understanding of the world. Okay? Apes, on the other hand, only ask questions to get things or to learn the names for things. They use language, for the most part, in a way similar to the pigeon that's been trained to push buttons in a certain sequence to get a reward. So you can train pigeons to push colored buttons in a certain sequence, say red, yellow, blue. And the buttons are actually transposable, so the experimenter can put the blue button where the yellow button was before. The pigeon will remember what order to push those colored buttons to get its brain reward, okay? It's pretty much what apes are doing with the lexigrams. They're just pointing to what they want. Tickle me, bananas, this sort of thing. Now, there are some cases where an animal asked for the name of something, which is kind of interesting. So there is this, he's dead now, but there is an African gray parrot by the name of Alex who's really, really famous. And once he asked a student who was eating a carrot what it was called and what color it was. And then he was later able to identify orange-colored things, and he sometimes asked for carrots. Now, it's sort of obvious that knowing the word for carrot was a means of getting a carrot, right? So, but what about orange? Well, you have to understand how Alex was trained. Alex was continually being asked, what color is this? What color is this? And if he gave the right answer, he'd get a reward, okay? So for him, knowing color names is basically a way of getting treats. And this is really different from what you'll see in children. Children don't just want to know about names, they also want to know about things. So for example, a child might come to her parents' laboratory and ask, what's that? And the parent might say, that's a centrifuge. But the child then is very likely to ask, well, what's a centrifuge? Okay, that's the difference. She's not just asking for a name. She wants to understand the reality. She wants to understand the thing. So if we contrast the animals with humans, I think a really interesting contrast is the case of Helen Keller, who we know is both blind and deaf. Okay. Upon being taught sign language, she eventually started asking questions about things and not just about the names of things. And I quote from her autobiography here. I had now the key to all language, and I was eager to learn to use it. Children who hear acquire language without any particular effort. The words that fall from others' lips, they catch on the wing, as it were, delightedly, while the little deaf child must trap them by a slow and often painful process. At first, when my teacher told me about a new thing, I asked very few questions. My ideas were vague, and my vocabulary was inadequate. But as my knowledge of things grew, and I learned more and more words, my field of inquiry broadened, and I would return again and again to the same subject, either eager for further information, end quote. Now, the apes that were subjects in the language studies, they had normal vision, they had normal hearing, they were exposed to all those different things that children were asking the questions about. They saw shadows, they saw the sky, they saw water, and yet none of them ask a question about these things simply to understand them. Okay, they might ask for water to drink it, but not to understand what water is. Language unlocked Helen's mind. She had ideas, kind of vague ideas at first, but could not express them, nor did she have a way of seeking new ideas. Whereas the language training the apes were given, all it did for them was gave them a new way of requesting things. A kind of similar test, in addition to this question test, it overlaps partially, is the conversation test. So here I'm defining a conversation as an interchange between two individuals about the same topic, where the individuals are sharing knowledge and they're seeking to acquire new knowledge. Okay, so this is a conversation between a mother and her three-year-old. So the three-year-old asks her mother, why is your tummy so big? And the mother says, I actually don't have a big stomach. The little girl says, yes, it is. Did you eat too much? Yes, darling, I must have. Okay, very short conversation, but there's a topic, the mother's stomach. The child is sharing knowledge about it, namely, it really is too big, and is asking questions about it. Okay. You will find nothing like that in the ape literature, nothing, okay? And even the people who are doing research on the apes, they admit that if you would find an ape that would have that kind of conversation, it would be a rational being, okay? And so sometimes they try to claim that their apes converse, but if you look at the actual transcript in one case, all it is a request stated in different words repeatedly, okay? And in the other case, the claim was made, and there isn't even a transcript to try to back it up. All right, so in the second part of the talk, I want to look at reasons that people typically give when they maintain that animals are capable of abstract thought. So the first reason that people often give is that animals can make tools. And obviously, some animals make tools instinctually. So, for example, when spiders spin a web, they didn't learn how to spin a web. It's pre-programmed in their genes or whatever. But we know that some animals actually learn how to make tools. And the chimpanzee is the classic example of a tool-making animal that doesn't just do it instinctively. So I'm just going to talk about one tool, a particular termite fishing tool that a particular group of chimpanzees makes. But what I say holds in general for how animals make tools. So not all the chimpanzees make termite fishing tools in the same way. So this particular group does it in this particular way. So the chimpanzees see the termites going in and out of the holes. So they use their sense of sight. And then they can either see or feel, or maybe both, that their fingers are too big to get in the holes. So now what they have to do, and this is very important, is they have to remember that they have a problem. I mean, let's face it, all of us have gone to the pantry at some point and then stood there wondering, what am I doing here? Okay, it's really important to have a good memory if you're going to be a problem solver. So the chimpanzee remembers, wants to get those termites, the hole is really small, and then it sees in the jungle these stems that have a leaf at the end. Now, the chimpanzee has an imagination, okay? It doesn't pick up like a tree trunk to try to stick it in the hole, right? Because it can't imagine the tree trunk fitting in the hole. But it looks at the leaf on the stem, and it can imagine the stem would fit in the hole, okay? So imagination is very important. And so they pluck up the leaf, and then I don't know if it's through trial and error or whether they just can't imagine the leaf part fitting because it's big. They rip the leaf part off. And then a kind of interesting addition they make to the tool is they run it through their teeth to fray the ends. So it makes it kind of like a brush, so it has a bigger area. And then when they insert it in the hole, before they insert it, they actually smooth down the bristles, so to speak, so that they don't get caught. And then they fish termites with them, okay? So they're basically using their senses. They're not using any type of mathematical formula or anything like this, but we have to remember that our senses, even the human senses, are very powerful problem solvers. We solve a lot of problems by using our senses. I gave the example earlier, tying your shoe, okay? You didn't learn how to tie your shoe by studying knot theory. You learned how to tie your shoe through vision and your tactile sense, okay? And another example where you learned how to do something which solves a big problem is riding a bicycle. You didn't study the principle of the gyroscope to learn how to ride a bicycle, right? You learned how to ride a bicycle by learning how to balance your weight by using your sense of touch. So there are so many problems that we solve in everyday life just using our senses and not using abstract thought. And if you think about it, if you had to pick between two people, one person who had book learning only and another person who had hands-on experience only, who would you pick to solve your problem, okay? So it's by no means diminishing the animal's ability to say that they solve problems using their senses. All right, so another reason that's typically given for saying that animals are capable of abstract thought is that some animals are able to categorize things. So pigeons in studies learn to pick out kingfishers from pictures of other birds and pictures of animals from non-animals. Alex the parrot was able to pick out what was the same and what was different in the case of color, shape, and material. And two chimpanzees were able to sort food and tools into two separate bins, one marked food and the other marked tools. And not only could they do it with the items themselves, but they could sort the lexigrams that symbolize those different items. We can't get into animals' minds, but we can form reasonable hypotheses based on our knowledge of our own mind. We're capable of mentally grouping things together that are similar without being able to articulate always in what the similarity consists. So, for example, a person can be really, really good at repairing cars, but be incapable of telling you how to do it. You have to show it to them. That person couldn't teach auto shop. That person couldn't write a book on the art of car repair. Their knowledge hasn't risen to the level of the universal. Similarly, for those of us who are English speaking, I'm sure we know how to properly use the definite and indefinite articles. But if I would ask you, how do you do it? I bet there's hardly anyone in this room who can tell me the rules according to which you use the articles. I myself learned this recently. At St. John's, we have a discussion partner program, and my discussion partner's English sounded horrible because he didn't know how to use the definite and indefinite article. And so I'm like, I don't know how to do it. I had to look it up, okay? But I know from hearing English spoken, I know how to speak correctly. My point is that a person through experience can have a collection of memories that it doesn't rise to the level of a universal that they can articulate, but passively it's there, okay? Now, without getting into animals' minds again, because I have other hypotheses what might be going on, okay, I think it's reasonable to think that they store similar memories together. Not only are all bananas roughly similar and able to be associated with a symbol for banana, but all foods are similar in being edible and thus can be associated with a symbol for food. And most animals are similar in having eyes, which is probably what allowed the pigeons to pick out the animals from the non-animals. Okay. Now, evidence, apart from my argument given earlier, the question test, that the categories the animals form are not universals, but collections formed on the basis of similarity, is that no experimenter has ever thought to test whether those animals that can categorize things grasp the relations of universality that obtain among their putative concepts. I mean, very simple question. If all A is B, is all B A? No one thought to ask an ape that, okay? And they didn't even think to ask it in a concrete term, like if all bananas are foods, are all foods bananas, okay? Similarly, no one ever tested an ape for basic forms of syllogistic reasoning, such as all raisins are sweet, all raisins are foods, conclusion. And I picked those words because those are words that it has in its vocabulary, okay? But no one ever thought to test the ape's ability because they realized that this type of abstract thinking is way beyond the ape's capacities. Can I take questions during? It's okay?
We typically wait.
All right, go ahead, please.
Is all in their vocabulary or just raisins?
Even if you did raisins, I mean, you would still get a conclusion from that.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's a fair question. All right, but even without it, you can do logic of the indefinite where you don't say some or all.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay. So, all right, moving on to the next reason that people think that the animals are capable of abstract thought, they sometimes seem to display moral behavior. So with human beings, we have something that some people term inequity aversion. So say, for example, you have two people working in a factory, and one person is stacking 100 boxes in an hour, and another person is stacking 50 boxes in an hour. Well, the one who's stacking the 100 boxes an hour is going to want a raise and is going to be annoyed if he doesn't get a raise, or is going to treat the other person as lazy and make comments, right? Okay. Well, we see something similar in animals. They did this experiment with capuchin monkeys. So capuchin monkeys, they're the organ grinder's monkey. They're really clever little animals, okay? So what they did in this experiment is they had two capuchin monkeys, each of them in their own cage, and each of them had to perform a task by itself, okay? And so say they had to press a lever. If they pressed a lever, then they would get a reward. Now, the reward the experimenters were first giving them were cucumber slices, which in capuchin land is a really low-level reward, okay? So, but what started happening at a certain point is, again, they can see each other. The experimenter started giving one of the capuchins a grape, which is like the gold, you know, prize for a capuchin. So the other one sees this and starts getting agitated. And the more the other capuchin starts getting grapes, the more agitated it gets to the point that it actually started throwing the cucumber slices out. Yeah. And another experiment which seems to show that animals have a moral sense was done with chimpanzees. So you had two chimpanzees each in its cage, and there was a table between the two cages. Each chimpanzee had a cord that it could pull, and what it would do would pull the table leg and cause the table to fall down, putting the food out of reach of both, okay? So the experimenters put some food near one chimpanzee and some food near the other chimpanzee. And if one of the chimpanzees started reaching over and taking the food from the other chimpanzee, then that chimpanzee would grab the cord and pull it, even though that put the food out of reach of both of them, okay? And animals also sometimes seem to display altruism. So they've done experiments with chimpanzees where a human being would drop a pen and then would be straining to reach the pen. And the chimpanzee would pick it up and give it back to the human, even though it wasn't getting a reward. Okay, so the human could drop it a number of times. The chimp now knows it's not getting a reward. It would still pick it up. And the experimenters even tweaked the experiment so that it was kind of hard for the chimpanzee to retrieve the pencil, but it would still do it. It would still expend a certain effort to give the pencil back. How can we explain this? I think this behavior can be explained by pro-social emotions. Franz de Waals is a very well-known ethologist, and he's done a lot of research on the notion of pro-social emotions. And his basic idea is this: if a single animal hunting could take down a squirrel, well, that's fine. But say that that squirrel hunted with others and they could take down a deer, then for the same amount of effort, each would get more food. Okay? But as Franz de Waals points out, if you're not getting your fair share for the amount of effort you're putting in, then it's going to be detrimental to your survival and reproduction. And so it's not surprising that cooperative animals are capable of monitoring whether they're being fairly treated. And if they're not being fairly treated, they get angry. But there's a difference between acting on emotion and acting on the basis of reason. We see this in parents sometimes, unfortunately. Okay, some parents, they just fly off the handle, they're aggravated with what their kid is doing, and they just, out of emotion, punish the child. Whereas another parent might be aggravated, but is punishing the child for the child's own good. Okay, and those two parents might actually mete out exactly the same punishment to their children. But there's a world of difference what's motivating their action. In one case, it's just uncontrolled emotion. In the other case, it's a moral principle of wanting to raise my child properly. Now, the evidence given earlier shows that animals do not have moral principles, since having moral principles depends on the ability to form abstract thoughts. Animals certainly have emotions. And having emotions to cooperate with others and to punish those who take advantage of them are conducive to survival and reproduction. So in sum, emotion can drive actions that resemble actions performed on moral principles. All right, so a fourth reason people sometimes give when they claim that animals are capable of abstract thought is that certain animals have passed theory of mind experiments. Now, I find the whole notion of theory of mind somewhat perplexing and not always very well defined. Oftentimes, a working definition of theory of mind is the ability to attribute mental states to others. But I have a couple questions about that. What counts as a mental state? Is seeing a mental state? Is feeling angry a mental state? Is an imagination a mental state? Is a belief a mental state? What exactly counts as a mental state? Okay. My second problem is, what does it mean to attribute a mental state? I think it's possible for an animal to recognize that a person is sad without having a concept of what sadness is. I think dogs know when their owners are sad. But as I've argued above, they don't have a concept of what sadness is. If this is so, then they're not attributing mental states to others in the same sense that a human being would attribute a mental state to others. All right, in any case, the gold standard for the possession of theory of mind is to pass the so-called false belief tests. And a classic example of a false belief test is usually called the Sally Ann test. How many of you have heard of the Sally Ann test? Yeah. Okay, so what happens is you have the individual being tested, and then you have either two puppets or two people, Sally and Ann. And so what happens is Ann puts a candy under a cup, and Sally sees it. Sally's looking, sees that Ann put the candy under the cup, and so does the other individual. And then Sally leaves the room. While Sally is out of the room, Ann takes the candy and puts it in a cupboard. Now Sally comes back in the room. And the individual who's being tested, be it a chimpanzee or a human being, is asked, where does Sally think the candy is? Now, apparently, very, very young children will say, Sally thinks it's in the cupboard. they can't associate their own knowledge from what, or they can't dissociate what others know from what they know. They don't have a clear concept that others know things. And when the child's older, obviously the child's going to say that Sally thinks it's under the cup. But if you ask a mature chimpanzee that question, where does Sally think the candy is, the chimpanzee will point to the cup, okay? So this seems to show that the animal has knowledge of what's going on in other individuals' minds. However, we need to ask this question. What does an ape understand when it's asked, where does Sally think the candy is? Is there any reason to think that this means something other than where will Sally look for the candy? Okay. So David Povinelli and Jennifer Vonk point out that the determination of where the other will look can be based on observing the other's behavior without having any knowledge of what's going on in their mind. One can see that someone is looking at something. Like you can see when I look down at my paper, right? Even dogs can follow gaze. Okay, so one can learn that individuals will seek a thing in the last place they looked at a thing. In other words, animals can associate action with action without grasping the intermediary of knowledge. Whereas we, in virtue of our capacity for abstract thought, by a certain age recognize that other people are knowers and not just actors. We can't assume that the ape that correctly answers where does Sally think the candy is understands Sally as a knower. A child by a certain age forms the abstract concept of knowing and so can say things like, she didn't see the candy being moved and so she doesn't know where it is. I'm not sure it's even possible to devise theory of mind experiments in which a behavior is only linked to a mental state and not to another behavior. So even though the apes pass these theory of mind tests, there's no way of knowing that they're not just associating action with action, that they're really recognizing that there is this intermediary which we know to be knowledge. Something similar can be said about deception. The ability to deceive others doesn't always require knowledge of what others are thinking. For example, you don't have to have an intellect to know that you can prevent another from taking something by hiding that thing. It's a matter of experience that if one covers something, the other won't take it. Franz de Waals recounts a story where a lower-ranking ape was about to mate with a female, and then the alpha male came by. Okay, and so what the lower-ranking ape tried to do was hide its erection. Okay, it knew that if the alpha male fixed its eyes on that imminent evidence that it was about to mate, it would attack it. Okay, and animals will use their knowledge of how other animals react to certain actions to their advantage, sometimes to deceive them. So in chimpanzee world, if you hold out an open hand, that's a friendly gesture, okay? And so the chimpanzee can do that. Another chimpanzee is probably going to come up to it. And then that first chimpanzee can bite it if it wants to and take advantage of the fact that the other one came up to it. There was a case where there was a chimpanzee that was being bothered by this other chimpanzee that was bigger and faster and stronger. Okay, so chimpanzee number one just couldn't run away, but chimpanzee really wanted to get away. So chimpanzee number one did this, looked off in the distance. And sure enough, the other chimpanzee turns around, looks, and then chimpanzee one runs away. Okay, but this could be simply correlating what happens when you gaze. When I gaze, others turn their head, they gaze as well. It doesn't necessarily have to go by the intermediary of, oh, it's going to think something is there. All right. The last reason I'm going to talk about why some people sometimes give as a reason for to back the claim that animals have abstract thought. It's not given real often anymore. Occasionally I see it, but it's not very popular. And that's the fact that certain animals have passed the mirror test. This supposedly shows that they have self-conscious awareness. Now, there's a big difference between consciousness and self-consciousness. So I think animals are conscious. So for example, if you have a chimpanzee in a room and part of the room is dark and there's a window and there's some light by the window, and you give the chimpanzee something, if it wants to see that thing, It knows it's not seeing it in the dark, right? It will move to the window. It's conscious. It's aware that it sees where there's light and it's not seeing where there's no light, okay? But self-conscious awareness is your ability to reflect on the content of your consciousness. All right, well, as far as the mirror test is concerned, dogs don't pass the mirror test. Dogs will look at, you know, see the image in the mirror. At first, they act kind of like it's another dog. But because that image doesn't have any smell, in a very short period of time, they just get bored, okay? They don't know what it is and whatever, sort of move on. But some chimpanzees do pass the mirror test. Now, how do they do this? I'm going to argue that the ability to pass the mirror test simply involves a greater form of body awareness. Even dogs have awareness of their bodies, okay? So a dog knows when you've put a biscuit in its mouth as opposed to putting a biscuit in the dog next to its mouth, right? And a dog knows when it's moving its paw and when you're moving its paw, okay? So higher animals do have a certain amount of body awareness, and this is through proprioception or kinesthesia, that we're aware, you know, that we're moving our hands and so forth. So it's a matter of perception. It's not a matter of abstract thought. Now, the animals that eventually recognize themselves in the mirror have a unified perception of the parts of the body that they both move and see. And so they recognize that the hand that they feel themselves moving is the same hand that they see moving, right? Otherwise, they'd be surprised when they move their hands. Like, what's that, right? Okay. And apparently, I don't know if it's true. I didn't research it, but maybe cats don't know that their tails are their own tails. A student was telling me if a cat catches the sight of its tail in its peripheral vision, it will start chasing it as if it was someone else's tail. I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, most animals have a sense that, an awareness that the part of the body that they're moving is the same part that they're seeing, okay? Now, some animals are further able then to imagine what their hand would look like even when they don't see it moving, okay? So they have this further ability to imagine what their hand would look like. And they're able to transpose in their imagination what their mouth must look like when they open and close their mouth, okay? So, I mean, if you have a puppet, it's like opening and closing the mouth, right? So they can imagine what their mouth looks like when it opens and closes. And this allows them then to move to the next step, which is the ability to imitate what are called invisible gestures. So I can't see my expression on my own face, but I can see the expressions on your face, okay? So, but if you make a face, if an animal is capable of doing this type of kinesthetic visual matching, it will be able to reproduce the same face on its face through proprioception, okay? So what happens in the case of these animals that actually recognize themselves in the mirror, they're familiar with mirrors. They know that if you take something and you put it in front of a mirror, that now it appears in the mirror, okay? So it's not like they're clueless about what goes on with mirrors. What hasn't happened yet is they haven't made the connection that holds true of their own body. So they're like waving, they're doing visual mapping, and then they're making faces, doing visual kinesthetic mapping, and then it clicks. I'm looking at my body. And then they'll sometimes use the mirror to, like, look at parts of their body that they can't see that well ordinarily and so forth, okay? All right. But I maintain that this is just a form of body recognition. Self-awareness requires knowing oneself as a self. When I look in the mirror, I see a white, skinny human with graying hair. My knowledge of myself is that I'm an impatient person. Okay, this is the fruit of self-reflection. When I comb my hair, a lot of times I'm not even thinking about myself. Okay, there's a world of difference between looking in a mirror to observe your body and self-reflection. So self-reflection would be something like, oh, I'm really impatient because this bus is taking really long, you know? And then I reflect on, well, should I get this impatient? It's free after all, and so forth. This is self-reflection, okay? Where you're looking at the content of your consciousness and making comments on the content of your consciousness. Combing your hair by looking in a mirror is not self-conscious awareness. All right, so are animals intelligent? Well, they're not intelligent in the sense of being capable of abstract thought. The natural perfection of an intellectual being lies in acquiring a conceptual understanding of the world. Accordingly, once an intellectual being acquires a sufficient vocabulary, it begins to ask questions about the world. Apes, however, never ask questions seeking knowledge for its own sake, but their questions amount to the same sort of thing pigeons do when they peck a certain sequence of colored buttons in order to get a grain reward. Their questions are the result of associative memory formed through reinforcement. We who are rational animals sometimes solve problems like animals do, using our senses in trial and error. But we're also capable of solving problems by the application of abstract principles, as, for example, when we send people to the moon. Even if many of us never learn such principles, we are at least capable of asking questions seeking to increase our conceptual understanding of reality. So we can ask, is there life on the moon? Can people live on the moon? Apes and other higher animals are intelligent in the sense that they can learn and solve problems using their senses, and this includes the internal senses of imagination and memory. So orangutans, for example, are intelligent enough to repeatedly outfox zookeepers and escape from their enclosures. But they lack the type of intelligence that would allow them to ask, are humans intelligent? Thank you.
So I think we can allow a good amount of time for questions.
Okay. Yes.
If I recall correctly, in Five Winds book on animal cognition,
yes,
I think it mentions that there's humans who have also like failed mirror tests. Because there's like a case, I think it's like prosophagia or something. It's the word like you can't recognize faces, some condition that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that just adds like extra, I don't know, evidence to your point there.
Right, so that it's some type of sensory ability that's been lost. Yeah, I appreciate that. I've read that book. I think that book is pretty good. Yes.
So I like the phrasing of your question about not so much about intelligence, but about abstract thought. But the question I have is, what's the consequence of that? Let's suppose that we agree that animals have no abstract thought.
Mm.
What is the consequence of that for us? Like, do we therefore treat them differently because they don't have abstract thought? You know, what are the other kinds of consequences? Or is it just like a academic question about this?
Oh, no, it's not academic at all, but you would have to invite me back for another lecture to talk about the ethical implications.
I mean, so is it abstract thought? I guess in particular, I'm concerned about the question. One of the dangers I worry about is we sort of, when often people phrase this kind of question, people often think like, well, you know, animals are not intelligent, really intelligent, they're not capable of, you know, this distinguishes us from animals, therefore, you know, they don't have the same, we aren't, you know, they don't have human rights, if you like, right? But I worry that that similar kinds of things can be said all about lots of people, right? So, you know, babies, for instance, you know, people who are incapacitated in various different ways. You know, and you say, well, they don't have the capacities for these kinds of things. What are the implications of this? So I guess that's maybe it's a whole different lecture, but I'm just kind of...
Yeah, it is pretty much a whole different lecture. I mean, I could embark on it, but I would rather kind of stay on topic.
Okay.
Yes.
I feel like something that I've seen recently in coverage of animals and is more like kind of a display of like, oh, look at animals, they have such empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a story that went very big online about a mother whale like carrying her dead baby for days, and all the scientists were so sad.
Yeah.
It was sad. It was a very sad thing.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious how that fits in, where either animals have a capacity for emotion or we're
absolutely
kind of assigning emotion to them in a way that's more human, but like, how do you fit that into a framework?
Oh, sometimes my students tell me at the end of my introduction to human nature course that at the end that animals don't have emotions. I mean, that is the most absurd thing that I've ever heard. If you have a dog, you know that animals are dogs are really sensitive to human emotion, okay? And I think the higher the animal is, the more emotional sensitivity that they have. And so, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to use this word in the strict sense, but chimpanzees form kind of like friendships among themselves. And it's a really well-known fact that certain types of dogs will become attached to either the alpha dog or the master, okay? And just as with a couple, a lot of times if he dies before she does, and she was perfectly healthy up to that time, a lot of times she'll die shortly after. And it's the same thing with dogs. Okay, if the master dies and that dog was attached to that master, the dog is sometimes becomes depressed and it dies. So I think they're incredibly sensitive beings and have a very wide range of emotions. And yes, I think they do show empathy and they do try to console people. There was one story about a chimpanzee. The researcher would fake cry. Okay, and this chimpanzee was a naughty chimpanzee. Usually it was really, really hard to catch it, you know. But she would fake cry, and it would come over, and it would be like doing display, like there was something attacking her, and would come and stroke her. And yeah, they're definitely emotional creatures. But what I was trying to say is that emotion without reason finally is not going to give you morality. So you can have too much compassion, right? And sometimes you have to have tough love. And some people that just go by emotion, then just have so much feeling that they can't do that. They can't make that judgment of reason. So I think that's true of animals. Yes?
I think it's pretty clear that two things about emotion. First of all, it's not intelligence. It's some sort of genetic behavior that's built into us.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Peck, in one of his books, he's written some of these pop psychology
books. The pathless, the roadless.
Exactly. But he says that sexual love is merely a trick that our genes play to hoodwink us in America. and he's got a point. But not only is it not intelligence, but it doesn't have anything to do with morality either. When you were giving the example of the monkey who would get angry at the other monkey getting something and then get it out of reach so neither of them can get it.
Right.
I mean, that's something that children sometimes do.
Yes.
And their parents might call it, I think the one of the common terms for doing something like that is cutting off your nose to
spite your face. Exactly. You're right. Yes.
So it was interesting when you made the distinction in regard to the mirror test, where animals that are advanced cognitively enough to recognize themselves in the mirror, you made the distinction between intelligence as we see it as abstract reasoning and like a kinesthetic awareness.
Yeah.
So, but I know that some psychologists, such as Howard Gardner, have contended that there's more to intelligence than just general intelligence of abstract reasoning. Like, there's other kinds, such as social intelligence, and kinesthetic intelligence is one of them. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were on the kind of the more multifaceted notion of intelligence as not just the capacity to reason, but also other things. Like, we generally don't consider a master trapeze artist to be highly intelligent, but and yet there's some people with some of the most developed cerebellums in the world, right? So I was just wondering what you thought about that. Since this lecture is, are animals intelligent?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, when you look at certain monkeys brachiate, you know, from one branch to the other, they'll beat any human trapeze artist, hands down. So if we're going to call that a type of intelligence, and I'm not necessarily against it, yeah, I think animals have that type of intelligence, too. What was the other type of intelligence you said?
Social intelligence.
Social intelligence. Yeah, I think they also have social intelligence. I mean, they know who their friends and foes are, and apparently with chimpanzees, becoming the alpha male is not just a matter of, like, being big and beating up the other ones, but it also has to do with making social affiliations so that they're backed. So I think they do have social intelligence. That's why I was also saying they have something that strongly resembles friendship. You know, they'll become attached to another specific individual and
right.
Do things for that individual that they don't do for others. And again, if that other individual would die, they would become depressed, you know. So I think they do have social intelligence. Yes, in the back.
A couple more. On the subject of animals asking questions, is it possible that when animals develop tools, they're asking questions within their own mind, and there's just no way for us to probe that, like, experimentally? So, for example, with the ape that makes the tool to grab the termites out of the mound, in some way, I can't imagine this animal not asking the question, what object can fit in this hole, right? And maybe they don't think of that as a question, but I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, again, I think you have to look to the apes that were enabled linguistically. What do they do with the language? What do they do with the language? So I see no reason to say, oh, well, this one out in the wild, you know, is actually thinking, but these ones in the laboratory, they're not thinking. When the ones in the laboratory are the ones that have language and could be asking the questions.
Go ahead. That could just be a result of the fact that they don't have the concept that they could interrogate another person or another animal with a question.
But they're being interrogated all the time.
Okay.
And also, actually, there was one case where a researcher was trying to make excuses why it's particular, I forget what it was, if it was a chimpanzee or a bonobo or whatever, but it was making this excuse and said, oh, well, we don't allow it time in our training program for it to ask questions. But you know what that I think it was a chimp used to do? It used to sometimes grab all the tokens and then run to some place and spell out all the sentences that it was trained on. So it had an opportunity, and then it was like, oh, now's my chance to ask a question because I've got the tokens, but I never ask a question. It just repeated, you know, what it was basically trained to do. Another question? Yes, please.
I guess I sort of have a question about the method that's being used to argue against animal intelligence, because it seems like the method is to explain away phenomena using association, but it seems like that could also be used for humans, and that even if you wanted to maintain, or even if it's, you know, easily arguable that human, you know, associative abilities are way above what animals currently do, I don't know that it's theoretically necessary to say that that is abstraction, because we have models like complex associative maps, or we have explanations of principles, which are supposed to be universals, that are also associative, you know, clusters where things that tend to happen, like X, tend to be followed by Y. And that's almost like a fake concept that's actually just an association of actions or phenomena. So it seems like if we're going to defend like abstraction and abstract reason in humans, we can't just explain phenomena. Does that make sense?
Because I wasn't trying to explain away association. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to do is I was trying to say, well, we are able to form abstract thoughts, and therefore we naturally do it. And then we try to acquire more thoughts, okay? So it seems to me if you have the natural ability to do something, it's like Noam Chomsky says, we don't think that humans had to teach birds how to fly, you know? They have a natural ability, they're going to flap their wings. So if they have this ability to form concepts, they're naturally going to do it, and they're naturally going to want to do it, and they're naturally going to ask questions like little kids. So if you think about it, which is a worse insult, to be called ignorant or to be called bad? If you call someone ignorant, I once did, mistakenly, you really get a reaction. And I was very narrow. You're ignorant about philosophy. She had never touched a philosophy book. But there's this very strong reaction that we pride ourselves on having a conceptual understanding of the world, okay? But these animals, they have no sense at all of wanting to have even the barest understanding of the world in terms of concepts. So association is great. That's what I was saying, is that if I'm going to pick between a person of experience who's associated things over and over and over and a person who has abstract thought book learning, I'm going to go with the person of experience. And that's why I'm saying I think animals are amazing beings and they can solve a lot of problems through experience. But I don't see them seeking an understanding of the world for its own sake, even when it would be very easy for them to do so. They have the words, they have the habits of being asked questions and so forth, and not a single question.
Okay.
that make sense, sort of? Yes.
One more
question. Only one more? You already asked one, didn't you? Okay, the... Okay, person behind.
So, I really appreciate you sharing your ideas and thoughts. It's a really interesting approach to kind of answering this question that I haven't seen or heard of before. So, I guess I'm just trying to like better understand it. I mean, we know that animals understand the concept of, like, for example, like death. You see animals mourning other animals, like the death of another animal. We have the example of the mother whale. And then, like, when horses, when their owners die, the way they walk when they carry their owners after death is different from when they carry them, like, when the owner was alive. I guess I'm just trying to understand how, like, whether that would be an abstract concept of death, or is that, like, how does that fall under...
Yeah, well, what I'm arguing is that they have a direct experience of death. They see this animal that used to be moving, no longer moving. And that's what death means for them. This animal is no longer moving. And then maybe they see another animal on another occasion no longer moving. And they see that those two things are similar. So they can mentally kind of group together these similar things of lifeless animals that before were moving around, but I don't see any reason to think that they form a concept, death, in the sense of a universal that they know applies to other beings and that sort of thing.
He falls over. He's no fun. All right, thank you very much.